Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. Hope everyone is having a great weekend, enjoying the great weather out there. Before we get too far into the show, though, I just want to remind you guys, U of A Wildcats, ASU Sun Devils this afternoon, 2:30 p.m. up in Tempe. If you've been listening to the station during the week, Jim Parisi's show, they gave away tickets to the game. You could be heading up there right now. You probably didn't, so instead you're having to spend your hard-earned money to buying your own tickets. So come Monday, you're going to have to go back to work and pay for them. Anyways, as always, you can stream us live here on powertalk1210.com. And if you can't listen to the whole show because you have to go to work, you can listen to it at your convenience by going to our website, solomononblast.com. Show's posted there in MP3 without all the commercials. Save you some time. You can catch our blog there also. Fred had a great article a couple weeks ago. A lot of wisdom in it that you don't want to miss. Wisdom, knowledge, and understanding of Solomon is definitely what we need to have in our lives in general, but even more specifically in the work that we do. Solomon is very clear that work is an essential part of life. He says in Ecclesiastes 3:22, "So I perceive that nothing is better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him?" And working hard is a wise thing because it brings rewards in many different ways. In Proverbs 22:29, he says, "Do you see a man who excels in his work? He will stand before kings. He will not stand before unknown men." But in this confused culture we live in, somehow work is seen as something that's to be avoided and not working as something to be rewarded for. Although I'm not sure things are much different now than they were in the past. For example, a British journalist by the name of Reginald Jebb wrote this: "To curtail the freedom of a people so that the lazy or inefficient members of the community should be enabled to remain lazy and inefficient is not only to impair the most precious attribute that mankind possesses, but it's also bound in the long run to destroy the economy of the country that practices it." And I think that's what we're seeing. When did he write this? Back in 1959. So maybe that's still too modern for you. About this, a letter Abraham Lincoln wrote to his stepbrother, John D. Johnson, in January of 1851. As his law and political career rose, he was often approached for assistance from poorer relatives, one of which was his stepbrother. He writes in a letter, "Dear Johnson, your request for $80, I do not think it's best to comply with now. At the various times when I've helped you a little, you have said to me we can get along very well now, but in a very short time I find you in the same difficulty again. Now, this can only happen by some defect in your conduct. You are not lazy, and still you are an idler. I doubt whether, since I saw you, you have done a good day's work in any one day." That's not very politically correct anymore. "You do not very much dislike to work, and still you do not work much, merely because it does not seem to you that you could get much for it. This habit of uselessly wasting time is the whole difficulty. It's vastly important to you and still more to your children that you should break the habit." Lincoln goes on to say, you know, you should go to work tooth and nail for somebody who will give you money for it. And for every dollar he earned, Lincoln offered to give him another, at least up to a point. He writes, "Now, if you will do this, you'll be soon out of debt. And what is better, you'll have a habit that will keep you from getting in debt again. But if I should now clear you out of debt, next year you'll be just as deep as ever." And because human nature never changes, no matter what point in time we look at, whether it's the past, the present, or the future, the lazy person exists, and being unable to control themselves ends up with someone else needing to control them. Solomon, of course, preceded both of these with his wisdom, knowledge, and understanding. He sums it up pretty well in Proverbs 12:24. "The hand of the diligent will rule, but the lazy man will be put to forced labor." So instead of listening to the culture that says we don't have to be a slave to the rich man, maybe we should be looking at ourselves and asking if maybe the real problem is the inherent laziness of man, not the rule of the rich man who got there because of his diligence. That's something to think about. We'll be right back after this quick break with more of Solomon on Blast. You want to call in? 750-7456. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. Day by day, pray. Well, Proverbs says in 21:12, "The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord like the rivers of water. He turns it wherever he wishes, And he says, by me kings reign and rulers decree justice. Well, if you've been listening to the news this past week, one of the big stories out there was the National Prayer Breakfast that occurred this past week. And the firestorm seems to be associated with some of the comments that President Obama made during that prayer breakfast in his speech. And I'll just kind of go through some of these, some of the actual speech itself, because I tried to play some of the audio associated with it, and I have to say that it was painful because he kept starting and stopping, so I can go through it quicker. He starts off and he says, good morning, give all praise and honor to God. It's wonderful to be back here. Then he goes on to say, tell people that he would appreciate them setting things up. He says His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, was a powerful example. He thanked him for being there, welcomed him to the White House and everything. He goes on with a bunch of just sort of jokes. But he says, slowing down and pausing for fellowship and prayer, that's what this breakfast is all about. I think it's fair to say Washington moves a lot slower than NASCAR. He was talking about Darrell Waltrip, who was just prior to him in the agenda. He says, certainly my agenda does sometimes also, but still it's easier to get caught up in the rush of our lives and the political back and forth that can take over this city. We get sidetracked with distractions, large and small. We can't go 10 minutes without checking smartphones. Yeah, a little more of his banter there. But he says, for 63 years, this prayer tradition has brought us together, giving us the opportunity to come together in humility before the Almighty and to be reminded of what it is that we share as children of God. He says, over the last few months, we've seen a number of challenges, certainly over the last 6 years, but part of what he wanted to touch on is the degree to which we've seen professions of faith used both as instruments of good, but also twisted and misused in the name of evil. And he goes on to talk about the fact that the particular attacks in Pakistan, the ones in Paris, show that those that profess to stand up for faith, profess to stand up for Islam, but are in fact betraying it. He actually said, we see ISIL, a brutal, vicious death cult that in the name of religion carries out unspeakable acts of barbarianism. But the one thing that he really kind of created the firestorm over was that he associated, he made the comment that, yeah, these people are doing this nowadays, but we can't feel like we're better than everybody else and not forget that there were things like the Inquisition and the Crusades that where people did the same thing in the name of Christ. So that seems to be what really has caused a firestorm, Fred.
The Oscar. This is really right out of the Alinsky playbook, and I know a lot of people throw that around, but the idea is the doctrine of moral equivalency. Whenever someone challenges an extreme position, you just turn around and say, other people did this exactly like this. And so that's supposed to dismiss any kind of inquiry or debate. Other people did this too. And so, yeah, if you're going to start equating things, I think it's fair for us to be able to look at it and say, what exactly are you equating? So he's going back to the Crusades in probably, right, what, the 12th century or so.
Right.
And trying to say that somehow there's this moral, you know, link between what the Christians did then and what the radical Muslims are doing today. Well, number one, his assumption, Doug, is that what was taking place 800 years ago or so was something that was completely unprovoked by the Muslims, that the Christians were just behaving brutally and aggressively and using their force to simply dominate the world, very much like Muhammad did in his day. And there is, that's a working assumption. You can't even question that this was all a one-sided affair. It was nothing more than the Christians beating up on the Muslims. And see, he's trying to reverse that. So who says that was the case? Since when? I mean, What moral authority does he have to establish that that was what was really happening then?
Well, he says the tendency in people is a sinful tendency that can pervert and distort our faith. And that's really what he was, how he was addressing it. People that have their own Twitter accounts and create these hate-filled bigotry out there. So he's bringing it from the fact that we're all basically have a sinful tendency. And it was really one short sentence out of his whole entire speech. There's a lot more to it in terms of, he says, you know, he had some basic principles that he was going to. We start with basic humility. He even makes the statement, our God is not, our job is not to ask that God respond to our notion of truth. Our job is to be true to him, his word, and his commandments, which are pretty significant.
I mean, that's a beautiful statement if it had any sort of substance to it. What commandments and words is he referring to? You know, he's on record for mocking the commandments in Leviticus. I've actually seen the clip. He's literally mocking those commandments, telling us how irrelevant they are. So I have to wonder, is he talking about Muhammad's commandment to kill the infidel? What commandments is he what's he referring to? It's rhetoric, but...
Well, yeah, but he's obviously making it with reference to the Christian approach from our country's point of view. I mean, you have to say, well, he's making statements that you and I would both absolutely agree with there,
yeah,
right?
On the surface you would, but, you know, you kind of get the wink and nod as he kind of defers to the Dalai Lama and people like that. I think we have proper reasons to say, wait a minute, what are you trying to say? Let me just kind of continue
Maybe he's being a little more.
Maybe he's coming out of the closet as a real Christian.
That's what I'm wondering. Is maybe, like I said at the beginning, you know, the king's heart is in God's hand, so he can turn it any way he wants. Maybe we're seeing a softer side.
He said all that to say this, that Christians are just as bad. Let's call it what it is. You know, he referred to the Spanish Inquisition. And, you know, that's a horrible chapter, truly, in Christian history and however you want to look at that. But, you know, one of the things that you have to do, I've studied this a little bit, is that Tomás de Torquemada, who was the Grand Inquisitor of the Inquisition, was eventually reined in. Now, I'm not justifying or qualifying. I'm just simply saying... He was eventually reined in by Pope Alexander VI, uh-huh. who wound up censuring him later in life for what he was doing. Now, you know, the world was way more regional in those days. It wasn't like you could immediately dispatch information came back slowly.
He couldn't Twitter him or text him.
We even heard this week about the death camps in Germany and in Poland and wherever the Nazis were holding. You know, we're holding down these peoples. We even heard that the Allies didn't actually know what was going on in those death camps.
Right.
Until they finally saw them and really had proof. That's one of the reasons why they finally took all that footage.
Right.
Because they wanted to document what happened. So what I'm trying to say is it wasn't like, you know, this one grand, conspiracy was in play. Now, there were a lot of evil things that took place, but the bottom line was eventually they were called on the carpet.
Yeah.
And so who's calling – what Muslim clerics are calling ISIS on the carpet?
Nobody is. But I think in looking at this, that was such a small part of his speech. It was just kind of we can't hold ourselves blameless and be able to – you know, call these people terrorists, we have to understand that history because there's a lot more to his speech with regards to the right things that we need to do from a national perspective as individuals that are clearly he's taking reference from the Bible. Now, before you come back at me, we do have a caller waiting. Brett's waiting. Let's get an input from Brett. Good morning, Brett.
Yeah, you're doing. I don't know if Jim's been a week, but Ken, I was listening to your conversation about what the president said. Now, since you think the wrong path of it, respectfully, my opinion.
You know what, Brett? You're cutting in and out really bad, and the I don't know whether it's your phone or your connection. Can you try and call back? Sorry, Brett. It's just that wasn't working.
Well, we'll wait for Brett. I want to make one more point.
Okay.
I'm gonna finish my knee-jerk reaction to this speech. His other reference to slavery, as if Christianity endorsed American slavery. I mean, that is a complete
falsehood. Stretch.
In England, it was William Wilberforce, who was a dedicated Christian that spent his entire life bringing down the institution of slavery, not only in England and wherever England ruled.
I see there's a movie, Amazing Grace.
Yeah, exactly. And he
based
teamed
on
up
his
with
life.
Exactly.
Right.
He teamed up with the writer of that song, Amazing Grace, who had become a preacher. And then in America, the abolition movement was absolutely driven and supported by the Christians in the North. And in fact, you go back and look at some of those writings, and the Southerners were referring to the abolitionists very clearly as religious fanatics trying to push their beliefs on the whole country.
Right.
So to assume that somehow fits in American slavery, and the institution of slavery fits into the side of Christians persecuting other peoples, it's an astonishing abuse of history, because I have to assume he knows better.
Yeah. Well, we'll be right back after a quick commercial break here, and maybe Brett can get back in. We'll give you a chance. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. In this next story, Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 2:10-11, he says, whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward from all my labor. He says, then I looked on all the works that my hand had done and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. Well, according to this particular article, all work is baloney, BS. I can't say that word. Sorry. But the article says work is BS, the argument for anti-work. Now, this particular guy that wrote this article believes that if you're like most Americans, you hate your job, or at best you checked out at work, but as much as you might complain about the place where you go spend most of your waking hours, there's a good chance you don't ever question the fundamental idea that you should be working. There was an essay by writer Brian Dean that argues that we need to reframe the idea of work itself and maybe replace it with anti-work instead. He explains that anti-work is the moral alternative to the obsession with jobs that has plagued our society for too long. It's a project to radically reframe work and leisure. It's also a cognitive antidote to the pernicious culture of hard work, which has taken over our minds as well as our precious time. So, according to this gentleman, we shouldn't be working, Fred, at all. Do you believe that? In any way, he says that work can leave us stressed, exhausted, demoralized, and often still poor, but we're still work obsessed, especially in the U.S., where we work more hundreds of hours more than any of these other countries.
Well, as we drift further and further from our biblical roots, the idea of work is going to seem less and less important. And, you know, again, we have to have a little bit of a Bible discussion here, because that's where we get the work ethic from. As it's been pointed out, the Protestant work ethic originally was the Jewish work ethic. And where that comes from really is the Bible. It comes with all the story all the way back to Adam and Eve, where they were put in charge. Even in paradise, they had a job, you know. They were put in charge of the garden, and they were there to be fruitful, multiply, and to labor, and to be industrious.
Well, in his article, he actually says that He refers to Genesis about the fact that once they got kicked out of the garden, it was basically work was punishment for the sin that they committed in the garden. And so he looks at it as punishment when we go to work.
Well, they actually had the mandate before the sin, but just to kind of follow his way of thinking, and there's a lot of different ways to look at this event, and trust me, for 3,500 years, there's been a running narrative going back to the Talmudic discussions into Christianity about these events. But I kind of tend to believe that it was always God's plan for man to be outside of that setting. And there, in fact, there's a Talmudic proverb that says something to the effect of Adam did not become a real man until he was evicted from the garden, which I think says a lot about what man is supposed to be. In other words, this was always in front of man, and working was going to help man define himself and find out who he really was and what was really inside of him.
Well, he says that he does refer to the whole moral framing as being the basis for work, but he really looks at it as being something that we've just been indoctrinated with over the years because of the Puritan work ethic, and that if you really get down to it, that you even people that are on welfare and that kind of stuff, we are referred to almost as if they're criminals because they're not working. And he sees it, like I said before, that work is really taken from the aspect of it's a punishment for disobedience, whether that's disobedience because you're too lazy or disobedience because you're not following the norm of the culture.
Well, I'd like to know who he is. Is he on an annuity? I mean, is this a trust fund guy we're dealing with here? So I guess your whole view of work could be completely different if you all have something to fall back on.
Well, that's why I find interesting is the fact that he's writing this article. His expectations, I'm sure, are that somebody's going to read it. Does he consider that not to be work? Because he goes to the other side and he says the opposite, the flip side of work is leisure. And he says leisure is actually a bad thing because it tends to reinforce the thought that you have to work in order to have leisure. It's kind of it's non-work for the sake of working is what
right.
he says.
this is kind of an inverted Sabbath day doctrine too. You know, where you have certain rules about not working on the Sabbath day and you have to go, you know, to all these extra lengths to make sure that you're not accidentally working. But, you know, this guy, he's kind of got this weird view where he's trying to twist these things around, but I think he's going to end up in the same place, and that is he's going to work really hard at not working. And then he will be working, and then he'll philosophically drive himself nuts.
And that seems to be what he's doing, because he says leisure, like happiness, tends to be something that's earned through work. So he doesn't even feel like happiness is something that you can just have without having to work. That's how you gain your happiness, and that's how you're going to gain your leisure time is only by working. You have to pay for
if
your
by
leisure
happy
time.
You mean, you know, 25 pounds overweight, unpaid bills, depression, bloodshot eyes from, you know, 14 hours of TV. I guess it's how you want to define happiness, Doug.
Yeah, the other thing that he attacks pretty significantly is the fact that we're always looking at employment numbers out there, and that high unemployment is bad, and that people are denigrated for being unemployed. So when you look at it from the fact that the whole society is kind of attacking unemployment, the ability to have leisure, he talks about the fact that consumerism is opposed by many on moral grounds, and anti-consumerist and anti-capitalist politics focus on corporate greed and its effects, but not usually on the worth ethic and this obsession with jobs. And that's now he's saying that consumerism or capitalism is actually a problem because it's really an obsession with people working.
Well, I think, it all sounds good, and I'm not saying that good, but philosophically, like, you can actually have this discussion. But when there's no industry, people are still going to have to work for survival. So basically, instead of looking down the road, planning, creating, you know, forming companies that can accomplish bigger tasks, etc., they're basically going to reduce in this with this kind of mentality. It's already happened. It's already exists in the world. You reduced the human experience down to the day-to-day struggle of putting food in your mouth. All industry really is about looking down the road, you know, and you know, trying to put some buffers in your experience so you don't have to live like that. Take all those things away. You better be on one of the Hawaiian islands with perfect temperatures because you're going to struggle every single day to eat.
And the bananas falling out of the tree for you.
Definitely want the coconuts and the bananas there within reach. So without that, what do you really have? You just have a bunch of people that are that have been reduced to having to simply, you know, hunt and gather. That's basically what he's saying.
He references another gentleman by the name of David Graeber, who stated, it's as if someone were out there making up pointless jobs just for the sake of keeping us all working. And you have to think, does this guy realize what the technology that we have today, where did all that come from? Didn't just come from somebody sitting around on his laurels wondering whether or not he should work or be lazy. And he actually says anti-work is really what we do out of love, fun, interest, talent, enthusiasm, inspiration, etc. Only a lucky few get paid enough from it to live on, though. Yet it probably enriches our lives and benefits society more than most jobs do.
It's just ironic, isn't it?
It absolutely is.
It just boils down to the same thing. Take the infrastructure completely for granted. Always assume it's there, and then you can basically do anything you want. But you begin to dismantle all of these, models, and what do you have left? You have no infrastructure, and I think this might be a girl.
Well, the girl writes the article
about Jeremy Rifkin.
About this guy, Brian Dean, that wrote the fact that the actual anti-work article. This is just a journalist referencing Brian Dean's article. And so I've got to think, yeah, has this guy ever had missed a meal in his life? Has he ever not had his iPod sitting next to him or any of the other technology that came about because of the Protestant work ethic, not in opposition to the Protestant work ethic? Now, there's also a whole group of... Millennials is everything out there, right? We're supposed to...
Easy.
We're supposed to bow down and worship when anybody does a survey on
millennials. Remember that old E.F. Hutton commercial? When E.F. Hutton talks, people listen.
Yeah.
The whole restaurant would go quiet. This is kind of what they're saying. Whenever the millennials get quoted or there's a survey, everyone's just supposed to just pause for a moment of silence and listen intently and make sure that we understand what we need to do next.
Yeah. We'll come back after this break and continue with this particular portion of it. Give us a call if you want to weigh in, 750-7456. We'll be right back. We're working for a living here. This next story talks, it's like we said it before the break there, it's about the millennials. And that initial story, I would say, was another millennial. He thinks people shouldn't work at all. This one was a survey done to explore what tomorrow's leaders think of business today. According to the results, business should focus on people and purpose, not just products and profit in the 21st century. These are from Deloitte's fourth annual Millennial Survey. They say, millennials overwhelmingly believe, 75% of them, businesses are focused on their own agendas rather than helping to improve society. And only 28% of millennials feel that their current organization is making full use of their skills. More than half aspire to become a leader, within their organization, and 65% of emerging market-based millennials, I guess these people aren't in the developed countries, say they would like to achieve the goal compared to only 38% in developed markets. Additionally, the survey found large global businesses have less appeal for millennials in developed markets compared to emerging markets. And development-based, market-based millennials also are less inclined than millennials in emerging markets to start their own business. Kind of interesting. But it's kind of the opposite side of the...
100 years ago, for example, if you did a survey, and this is a sizable one, 7,800.
Yeah, it's not...
And you asked them about goodness in the marketplace, I think an overwhelming number of the respondents would have said, we need to apply our Christian values to our business dealings. I think it would have been an overwhelming number 100 years ago. And the reason they would have, not necessarily in terms of how Christian they were, I think it would have been something they saw as a good person saying. And so when you ask these questions to millennials today, I think it really has very little to do with what some, I'm sure, what they actually want or expect. It has a lot more to do with what they feel a good person should say. You know, this is what where a good person should stand.
So it's basically
this is the proper posture.
A political correctness.
Yeah,
approach
I think a lot
answering.
More than they even know.
Right.
It's the same way religious people do this all the time, right? They tell you what thinks. They tend to say things that they think are acceptable
and
to another religious person.
And what you want to hear.
What you want to hear. And they don't want to cause any waves. And they don't want to see themselves as being on the wrong side of the issue either. So they don't really think about what they're saying. They'll say it because they know that's kind of the currency of discussion.
If I can weigh in, I think...
As a millennial, please do.
Right in the middle of that, yeah. I think a lot of it's just rhetoric. I mean, they've been told that companies are kind of in it for themselves, and so they just, like you said, instinctually,
that's their belief.
That's what they say. I have a big problem with that first article on this part. Rufkin or whatever Rifkin says it isn't to say that there's no need for human labor. Obviously, there is, but if you can look at the figures for human labor requirements to, say, produce food for society, you can see what a staggering effect advancements have had. They reduce work requirements to a tiny fraction of previous eras, mainly saying that not that many people are going to work.
Because technology is going to take over and give us everything we need without having to work.
And I'm combining this with the millennial thing because knowing millennials.
Yes.
If they're saying that, let's say they're saying half, which I think he's implying that's far less, like 25% of the human labor that we have is actually needed. Who's gonna be the 25% that does it?
Somebody that wants to work, obviously.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I'm not gonna want to be doing human labor.
But you know what?
Who's gonna be the ones that? I mean, he says that we're still gonna need human labor. Who's going to be the 25% that steps up?
But the philosophical discussion is even pretty superficial because at the end of the day, all work is meaningful, right? I mean, you can say picking lettuce is not a meaningful thing to do. Hey, picking lettuce puts,
lettuce on the plate for
put
people.
Put lettuce on it. Yeah, exactly. It puts
it's not going to jump off there.
A quasi-vegetable on a hamburger, you know? So there is a purpose in all work. If you really think about it, it's inherent in work.
Right.
And that's exactly where the work ethic comes from. So to try to philosophically separate, and what they're really saying is, my company donates to green energy, so they have a purpose.
Right.
As opposed to
my company
generating jobs where people can take care of their families and
they don't
pay
look
taxes
behind
into the system and whatnot.
Yeah, they don't look behind the scenes at what it really takes. Matthew's waiting on line one there. Matthew, you want to?
Yeah, I want to chime in just by saying, with regards to the idea that there's no work or people shouldn't work is sort of ridiculous in this notion. People, when we have unemployment like we've had for this several years at the rates that they are. And probably, even though the rate is down, there's still probably a high level of real unemployment.
Right.
The reality is unemployment is because the system isn't functioning at its optimum level. There is never enough work not to do. I mean, think about it. When you tell me that
absolutely.
We've cured...
Yeah, you're right.
When you tell me we've cured cancer, that everybody has a home, that everybody has nutrition, when you've cured diabetes, obesity, when you've cured every one of those things, then you can tell me that there's no more work to do. When you tell me that there's not a child that goes to that isn't learning at his optimum level, when you tell me that a child doesn't have enough clothing and food or resources to be the best person he can, then maybe you could talk to me about there's not enough work to do. There is an absolute endless. The length of our imagination is the length of work that is what is left to be done.
Absolutely. Very well said. We appreciate that, Matthew. And he's right. And I think, like we started before with regards to the whole millennial thing, these guys have never lived anywhere but in a society that is they've had everything that they needed. And they don't see the rest of the world because the rest of the world isn't important to them, even though, you know, from the aspect of, oh, we got to, you know, help the make sure the earth is okay and we don't pollute the
yeah, you
air.
Know, and I give them a pass. When you're young, you have a lot of ideals. And you realize that a lot of these ideas blend, you know, after a while, just, you know, they find their own level. The way I would react to this now is what they're really more interested in is not so much a company that has a purpose, but a company that runs commercials that posture as if they have a purpose. And to me, maybe I'm from a different time, a different previous generation, to me, when a certain product runs a sanctimonious commercial about how much they care about the environment or whatever, I mean, it's kind of like, come on, man, you're just trying to make a buck. Just get it over with. Bring the game back. You know, that's my reaction to that kind of stuff. It doesn't impress me when one of these companies tries to make it look like they're, you know, they're drilling for oil for your benefit. I mean, come on. We know you're trying to make money. Make your money and that
right and provide us the service that
and
we
millennials
want.
Have been taught to look at that and say, wow, they care, you know,
but not worry too much about anything else in the rest of the world. We'll come back with another segment here, Solomon on Blast, right after these commercial breaks. Okay, we're back with Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210 now. All that talk about work, here's an interesting article about going to work and what this particular office is doing in Switzerland, I believe, is where they're at. It says, title of the article says, Office Puts Chips Under the Staff's Skin. So you want to gain entry to your office, you want to be able to get to work or go on a bus, perhaps buy a sandwich. We're all getting used to swiping a card to do all these things. But at Epicenter, a new high-tech office block in Sweden, somewhere over there, Scandinavian, they are trying a different approach, a chip under the skin. Felicio de Costa, whose company is one of the tenants, arrives at the front door and holds his hand against it to gain entry. Inside, he does the same thing to get into the office space he rents, and he can also wave his hand to operate the photocopier. That's because he has a tiny radio frequency identification chip, RFID, about the size of a grain of rice implanted in his hand. Soon, others among the 700 people expected to occupy the complex will also be offered the chance to be chipped. So are the millennials willing to be chipped in order to get into that job and work and have a purpose? Is this something that we're seeing happening?
Well, I want to draw attention to something that most millennials would know nothing about, a name from the past that some people might remember, whether you consider yourself a churchgoer or a Christian or whatever, and that's the name Hal Lindsey. Hal Lindsey wrote a book back in the 70s called The Late Great Planet Earth. Some people might remember that. And in this book, Late Great Planet Earth, he describes and discusses certain verses in the Bible that say in the very end of time that a false Christ would emerge, and one of the marks of his regime would be that he would require every single person, in order to buy or sell, to engage in commerce, have a job, do business, that they would have to take a mark on their forehead or on their hand. And he speculated, this part's not in the Bible, that part is, but he speculated that technology would come along, and this was almost 40 years ago, mm-hmm. that technology would come along where information would be able to be kept on a person, on their body, underneath the skin. And it's a pretty amazing prediction that we actually see materializing right before us.
Yeah, and the article, a related article, talks about this group. They're a bunch of tech entrepreneurs, students, web designers, and IT consultants. But at night, they transform supposedly into cyborgs. And he says that this particular young kid, and they all look like they're in their 20s, maybe 30s at the most. He says what he did was he organized an implant party, which took place actually back in late November. It was one of the several he's arranged. 8 volunteers were implanted with a small RFID chip, and then he's starting small, aiming to get 100 volunteers signed up, and 50 people have already been implanted, but his vision goes much higher. He says there will be 1,000, then 10,000. I'm convinced that this technology is here to stay, and we will think it nothing strange to have an implant in your hand. He finds volunteers through social media and hacker communities in Sweden, because people are used to tinkering with the technology. And he says currently it just acts as a simple security device. But he says there's so much more potential for that. You can log your life. You can, you know, these fitness wearables that are external could be made something that you could put under the skin.
I mean, yeah, think about the buying and selling prediction again.
Mm-hmm.
How many of us use our iPhones at Starbucks, and now the iPhone 6, you can even use it at Macy's, where you take that information, that little barcode, and it really is very convenient not to have to go into your wallet and pull out a card or cash. And so it's really not even a leap. It's just a small little stutter step between that and getting all your financial information on that chip.
Right.
Right.
And now they actually have a company by the name of, I think it's MC10, has created a thing called BioStamp. It's a digital tattoo, and it can be stamped directly on the body and collects data on body temperature, hydration levels, UV exposure, and more. As with other wearables, the data can be uploaded. This is just a tattoo. You don't even have to put it under your skin. And there's a lot of these companies. One, Proteus, developed a pill with an embedded sensor that works in tandem with a patch worn on the skin, and when swallowed, measures a range of body functions. These things are already here. The real question is whether they can work better if they're on our skin or inside of us. And one big advantage, they say, is that you can't forget them at home like you can your phone.
Absolutely. And so you do this, and you begin to tell people, just like they had to do, you know, with digital signals, analog signals and digital signals, where you had to comply by a certain date, right?
Absolutely.
Where your basic analog signal would no longer work.
Yeah.
And it's probably coming to a point where it really all makes sense. It's coming to a point where you get this tattoo or whatever you want to call it, and by such and such a day, if you want your account accessed at Fry's, you better have it, right?
Right.
And we won't accept cards anymore. We won't accept cash anymore.
Well, I noticed that in October of this year, all the credit cards are supposed to be converted over by October to have the chip in them, in the credit card, with a PIN. So you can no longer just swipe your card. You're going to have new credit cards that have a chip built into them and have a PIN associated with it in order to try and limit you know, people stealing identity and being able to process things. So it's heading that way already this year, specifically in the area of the credit card.
And it is kind of, to me, shocking to actually see it in real time, where a man is simply taking that step. And those of us that have read this stuff and been aware of it for some time, it really does kind of make you wonder, where are we going and how fast are we will it take to get there?
Yeah, it seems like it's not far away. Well, we'll come back in a minute with our One Greater Than Solomon segment right after this quick break. We're back with Power Talk 1210 in our One Greater Than Solomon segment. This particular article, pretty outstanding. Doctor, mom says prayer restarted a dead boy's heart. When rescuers arrived to Missouri Lake, St. Louis on January 19th after reports that three 14-year-old boys had fallen through the ice, John Smith had already been underwater for 15 minutes. The report says he was taken to the hospital with no pulse, and while his companions were treated for hypothermia, staff performed CPR on him for 27 minutes. He was dead for 45 minutes, the doctor told him. There was very poor chance of survival, but when the doctor called John's mom into the room, she started praying loudly, he says. Adds Joyce Smith, I don't remember what all I said, but I remember, Holy God, please send your Holy Spirit to save my son. All of a sudden, I heard them saying, we've got a pulse. We've got a pulse. Today, John's brain function is normal, and he's at home walking and talking like any other teenager. He's getting physical therapy to regain some movement in his hands, but otherwise, he's only battling a cough. After listening to what the paramedics and doctors said, I'm pretty surprised at the outcome, John says. Dr. Sutter, who says John's heart started within a minute or two of his mom's prayer, and he later wrote a note to make sense of the experience. His heart was jump-started by the Holy Spirit listening to the request of his praying mother, it reads. Another doctor adds that it's a bona fide miracle. So John's rescuers had practiced ice rescues just days before he was saved, but I'm not sure that really made much of a difference. So there you go. There is still the power of the Holy Spirit, the power of prayer in our lives. We don't want anybody to forget that all it takes is speaking to God. And it kind of goes for the president and that whole prayer breakfast. Maybe their agenda was a little bit different than this mother's, but I think hers was a lot more significant than anything that was said in that prayer breakfast. Until next week.